Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I think the first thing I'd like to emphasize is that in heart, lung, and blood diseases, it's very early days for nanotechnology. We haven't even really begun to take the first big step into this arena. So our effort has been really an exploratory adventure into the possibilities. There's tremendous opportunity in heart, lung, and blood for nano devices and nano drug carriers, micro drug carriers, for a lot of reasons. Number one is because this is normally an interventional medicine. In order to sample blood, in order to treat blood, in order to get to the heart, you typically intervene intravenously or through surgery, and that's very different than many other diseases. So you can deliver all different types of nanoparticles, drug delivery carriers, without having to worry about oral bioavailability. There's certainly new needs for new methods for detection and monitoring, just like the one that we saw for diabetes. Similar types of things can and need to be done in heart disease. We need new drugs, new delivery vehicles, artificial cells, and I'll talk a little bit about potential for synthetic particles with HDL. So we got a group of people together to apply for one of National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute's programs of excellence in nanotechnology. And our development pipeline is essentially something like this. We have groups that are working on novel nanoparticles. We have a physics group working on novel particle characterization and detection schemes. We have some really unique targeting approaches that some of the biologists and biochemists are experts at. And we have a series of biologists that have all the expertise in animal models that we need in the areas of thrombosis and atherosclerosis. So Dr. Zasadinsky touched on the idea of therapeutic index, and I just want to expand upon that a little bit. That is essentially what we're trying to do. But there's a couple of other points that I'd like to make, and that is that in heart disease, particularly in the area of atherosclerosis and thrombosis, there's been an immense amount of drug discovery. So several dozen compounds have been found that actually work in animals and are able to reverse plaque or to prevent thrombosis, but you can't deliver these systemically because they're toxic, they have some other side effect. So one of our strategies, one of our beliefs is that if you develop the appropriate nanocarriers, then you can rescue all of these compounds that certainly are effective, but that are unsafe. And that eliminates this 7 to 12 year discovery cycle that you're trapped in if you start with the fundamental biology and go to a small molecule. The other potential here is for delivering biologics. And I'll talk a little bit about the potential for delivering not only a biologic, but a biologic in combination with a drug. Okay, so what's the underlying problem? And I'm going to emphasize some of the biology here because I think that's something this audience is not familiar with and would be interested in. Heart disease is number one killer in the Western world. Every year in the U.S., 1.5 million people have a heart attack. 600,000 people die, a third of these within the first 24 hours, and a major percentage of those never have any symptoms. They just die, sudden cardiac death. And that's probably on the order of 100,000 people a year. There's no evidence, no pre-existing evidence of any of their medical visits, their checkups, that anything's wrong with them. They just die. So there's a tremendous unmet medical need here. I'll point out that everything that we're doing from a mechanistic standpoint is also relevant to stroke. I don't have the statistics on deaths and morbidity due to stroke, but the underlying biological mechanisms, particularly at the cellular and molecular level, are very similar. And so virtually everything that we're attempting to do is also relevant to stroke. Stroke also provides a little bit more opportunity because the arteries that you're actually trying to treat are more exposed than the arteries in the heart, so you have much more potential for external control and influence. In fact, sonography is already used in stroke, and you can imagine that you can combine sonography with the appropriate nanoparticles and affect an even better therapy. So cost is a big deal in this political climate, particularly medical costs. We're talking on the order of billions of dollars a year. These are split out by direct and indirect. Direct meaning what's your actual cost for your visits in the hospital. Indirect, what's your lost productivity. And you can see that heart disease and stroke have massive costs. So how does all of this start? Why do we get heart disease? What's the etiology and the progression of heart disease? So you're looking at a cross-section of a vessel, and this is essentially going to the right time or progression of the disease. You might expect that this is what your vessel would look like probably when you're 10 years old. Autopsies have shown that in most children around age 13, right around puberty, you can see the first evidence of heart disease, which are called fatty streaks. These are essentially cholesterol that has built up inside of macrophages inside your vessels. As you move forward, some people, and we'll call these vulnerable patients, will develop an inflammation of those fatty streaks. So you can really consider atherosclerosis, which is what leads to heart attack, as your blood vessel having arthritis. That's really the key. It's the immune system attacking this lesion of fatty streaks that leads to much of the trouble. So as that happens, it becomes an environment of its own. It almost becomes an organ of its own. It begins to build its own extracellular matrix. Scar tissue forms. More white blood cells come. This is like an abscess. It's a very bad thing. And this can rupture. And when it ruptures, then you get occlusion. And occlusion is heart attack. It's very important to recognize and to realize that not all atherosclerotic plaques are the same. In fact, we all have atherosclerotic plaques. We can break those down into two very large categories, the unstable plaque and the stable plaque. So the stable plaque is just fine. It used to be that in this field, it was thought that all plaques, particularly those that got larger, were the ones that caused the disease. And that's not the case at all. You can have plaques that occlude 50% of your blood flow, and you're just fine with those. They'll remain stable. It's the plaques that actually rupture that cause the problems. I'm sorry. So what happens in these plaques is you get a fatty deposition. This is cholesterol and macrophages. And you don't get the formation of an extracellular matrix that stabilizes that lesion. So you can imagine as blood is flowing, this is responding to the blood flow. And it will actually rupture. And when it ruptures, your body treats it as if it's a wound. It recruits platelets to try and stop the bleeding that it's sensing, although there is no bleeding. And those platelets essentially build up and occlude the artery, and that's a heart attack. Unstable angina, which is something that you may have heard of. You may have relatives that have this. Unstable angina is where this has actually ruptured, and you have a set of platelets sitting on here, but it's not full occlusion. And the platelets will come and bind, and then they will release. And this is why people go through episodes of pain. The point that I want to make here is that we have a number of animal models that we can use to recapitulate atherosclerosis. In part, these have arisen because we can genetically manipulate mice. So we have genetically manipulated mice so they're lacking ApoE. And when you lack ApoE, you get cholesterol buildup in your vessels. So this is a mouse that is defective in ApoE. And then we can actually speed up the disease by placing a cuff around the vessels in this mouse. And you'll see just with a small plastic cuff in a matter of weeks, this mouse develops full-blown atherosclerosis. And if we actually do a little bit more manipulation, we can cause that to actually rupture. And you can see inside this vessel right here, these are the platelets that have come to occlude the vessel, and there's obviously no blood flow. Even here, the mouse is fine because it can get some blood flow through this little inner lumen. But once it's ruptured and platelets come and occlude that, then the mouse has a heart attack. So we have the experimental systems to actually begin to devise and test some of our nanoparticles. So this is current state of the art, which you're probably also familiar with. This is how a stent works. The engineering of stents is very elegant, but the way, the mechanism by which they work is not elegant at all. You essentially put a sheath into an artery, and then you use a balloon to actually expand this metal sheath, and it simply takes the vessel and opens it up just by pressure. So you're just squishing the plaque to the outer part of the vessel, and you're creating an opening. So this is standard care for people that have atherosclerosis in an advanced stage now. And it's fairly remarkable. You can go in and get a stent and be out of the hospital the next day in many cases. We're trying to do something a little bit more elegant and to achieve effect far before you would actually have to get a stent, or in cases where you're not aware that you have plaque and you get into trouble with MI. So there are a couple of places where you can therapeutically intervene here. One, we're trying to develop particles that will intervene when the plaque ruptures and you get a thrombus. This is a really dangerous and acute condition. This is what leads to MI within minutes to hours. We see the opportunity actually to take some of these unstable plaques and use self-assembling polymers to stabilize them. And then there are other opportunities way upstream to try and change your blood cholesterol, and I'll talk at the end about those. One of the keys here is to be able to target nanoparticles to plaque, and this is one of the areas where we have a distinct advantage. If you can't target nanoparticles to the plaque surface of thrombus, then you really have no advantage. And Erki Ruoslahti has developed, who's here at UCSB and also at the Burnham, developed a method that he calls in vivo phage display. And you can essentially use a phage library. This is a virus for bacterium that displays peptides on its surface, and you can display a library of about a billion different combinations of peptide sequences. And what he has shown is that you can inject these into the mouse that has atherosclerosis or cancer, and you can recover the actual phage that bind to the lesion that you're interested in. In our case, atherosclerotic lesions. Once you recover those, you can determine the sequence of the peptide, and you can then use that peptide in a synthetic form, as you'll see in a bit, to actually target nanoparticles. So we're actually using biology here to deliver molecular diversity, and then we're harvesting that molecular diversity for our own benefit. The other targeting strategy that we use is to simply use a biological mimic. So these are some of the proteins that are expressed on the surface of the platelet, which is the cell that causes occlusion, a key one being GP1B-alpha. It's a platelet receptor, and it binds to a blood protein called von Willebrand factor. That interaction in particular is essential for building a platelet aggregate and a platelet thrombus, and we have devised nanoparticles in which we can conjugate a very small portion of von Willebrand factor and get that to bind to the platelet surface. And I want to tell you about that a little bit right now. This is actually a video. We've taken these stills, a video of a mouse that has actually been injured. We've injured its aorta, which is a small drop of ferric chloride, and that causes a little bit of a lesion that begets platelets to begin to adhere. And within a few minutes, you actually get full occlusion of that vessel. So in this experiment, we have fluorescently stained the platelets green, and those are in the top panels. And you can see that this is about 7 minutes after injury. You can see that those platelets have begun to occlude the artery. This is full occlusion. So the boundaries of the artery are right here and right here. You're looking at it side on. These are what platelet aggregates, platelet thrombi, look like inside of an artery. And then in this experiment, we have actually delivered nanoparticles that are coated with a mimic of von Willebrand factor. And you can see these are now fluorescent red, but you don't see the red, you just see the fluorescence here. When those are injected about 3 minutes after we've started the injury, those nanoparticles begin to accumulate with those platelets. If we do the control experiment and just make a mutation in this von Willebrand factor mimic, it's a very small single amino acid point mutation, we get no targeting of the nanoparticles to the thrombus. So I think this is one of the big successes of our program, in that we now have a way of targeting biocompatible nanoparticles to vessel occlusions, and we're on the edge of doing two big things here. One, we can now begin to image these with MRI, potentially even with ultrasound, and we can deliver therapeutic agents here. Many of you probably heard about tissue plasminogen activator, which used to be in vogue for treating people with heart attack. We can coat these nanoparticles and encapsulate TPA, and we believe we're going to be able to enact the dissolution of this clot. Okay, coming back to some of the targeting using the phage peptides, Dr. Zasadinsky talked a little bit about this. Dr. Ruslati and Matt Terrell, who used to be at UCSB, who's now at Berkeley, have been working on these protein-analogous micelles. So these are structures that actually self-assemble. They're part peptide, part micelle. And on this, you see a long lipid chain. You can put a phosphate head group, polyethylene glycol. You can decorate this with a number of things. In this case, it's been decorated with a fluorophore, but also one of the phage peptides that I talked about that Dr. Ruslati had selected to bind to atherosclerotic plaque. And in this experiment, what they've actually done is inject these particles into mice that have atherosclerosis, and you can see they have detected fluorescence along the entire vasculature of this mouse. If you were to open this up and just look at it visually, you can see the plaques, they're so large. But here you're seeing the targeting of those protein-analogous micelles to the surface of plaque. This is in the aorta. You can see that if you do the same thing with micelles that lack that peptide or have a peptide with a point mutation, you get no targeting. If you do a cross-section of this, you can actually see that these micelles are targeted to the surface of the plaque. If this were a non-diseased animal, this would just be essentially an open vessel, a ring. You can see the atherosclerotic plaque here. With in blue, you see the staining of nuclei of cells. So some of these are monocytes, some of these are macrophages. And these protein-analogous micelles that we've targeted are binding to the surface of the plaque. And what's most interesting is that they're accumulating at this shoulder of the plaque. And the shoulders of the plaque are regions that actually have very high shear stress, a lot of eddies, and this is where you typically get plaque rupture. So we think we have a delivery vehicle here that we can use as a prophylactic. For people that are in great danger of having plaque rupture, we now have a way of sending drugs or biologics to the surface of plaque, and particularly to these regions which are vulnerable to rupture. Dr. Zasadinsky talked to you about his vasosomes and hollow gold nanoshells and how he can use near-infrared light to burst these and deliver agents. I'll say that I was just at a conference at Harvard where one of the other programs of excellence in nanotechnology presented, and they are developing catheters that you actually put right in through the vein and can go all the way up into the heart, and those catheters can develop or can deliver near-infrared light in a very localized region. So my hope is to convince Dr. Zasadinsky to encapsulate some important drugs, and we'll attempt to target those with his vasosome targeting agents and activate them, release the drug with the near-infrared catheters that have been developed at Harvard. Dr. Mitra Grotrys Goop, who is the chair of this session, has done a really fantastic job developing ways of changing the shape of micro and nanoparticles, and this is a menu, a library of shapes that they figured out how to develop. I think the most striking thing that I've seen out of their group is this slide, which Dr. Mitra Grotrys' students, graduate students, presented at our meeting at Harvard, and he presented it without labels down here, and he asked the group, can you tell which one is a normal red blood cell and which one is a synthetic red blood cell? And you know, there were a bunch of biologists in the audience, and it was about 50-50. And you can see that the synthetic red blood cells look almost exactly like normal red blood cells. And the important, one of the important things about red blood cells is that they are larger than your capillaries, so they actually have to squeeze or distend in order to get through these capillaries. Dr. Mitrogosri's group has actually been able to make these synthetic red blood cells so that they will distend, they will collapse, and you can get them through the small capillaries. So we think this is a way of actually delivering blood. And I would also say that Dr. Mitrogosri's group has done a similar type of thing with making synthetic platelets. So if you're in a car accident or you're on the battlefield and you go through some trauma which you're bleeding internally, physicians have a very difficult time of identifying where that lesion is. And if we can develop methods or deploy methods for delivering synthetic platelets, synthetic red blood cells, then that'll go a long way in trauma medicine that's relevant to heart, lung, and blood disease. One of the other things that our group has been working on is developing methods to actually detect nanoparticles. And from the standpoint of blood disease, I think it's important to realize that we studied blood at the micro level and above. We know what cells are in there. We know what particles are in the blood when you get to about a micron. We can measure that. But we have no idea what's really in the blood at the nano level. So Andrew Cleland's group has been developing methods to actually detect nanoparticles, and I won't go through the specifics here, but the important point being that they can now very accurately detect differences between nanoparticles of 200 and 100 nanometers, and the most recent data I've seen is all the way down to around 50 nanometers. So this is going to be a tremendous discovery element for us. What is the composition of nanoparticles in an individual's blood? Does this track with disease? Does it indicate disease? What's the variability in the patient population? One of the important nanoparticles that you do have in your blood is LDL and HDL, and so this may be a method of actually detecting the entire population, measuring the entire population of LDL and HDL in your blood.
A lot of what we do is about timing. And so a lot of what you're talking about, you know, delivering, restoring blood flow and things like that in the heart or in the brain, it's all about timing. Mm-hmm. What can you do or what's on the horizon to improve flow, what we can do maybe in the ambulance?
That's a great question. And it's interesting when you can consider tissue plasminogen activator, which is an approved drug and which does restore blood flow, and probably 10 or 12 years ago was a standard of care for people that were having a heart attack. Tissue plasminogen activator has some problems because it causes bleeding at other sites. So it is not in favor in the United States anymore, and there were actually some trials in the United States where they tried to deliver tissue plasminogen activator in ambulances, in emergency care settings, and they were without success. However, if you look at France, they have set up an entire system so that they very safely and effectively deliver tissue plasminogen activator in the ambulance. And their survival rates go way up because of that. So we believe that if we can actually take tissue plasminogen activator and put it on these nanoparticles, send it directly to the site of the thrombus, where you're getting the occlusion, then you can eliminate all of these bleeding problems at other sites. So I think in terms of acute care and emergency care, dealing with sudden cardiac death, that's the big opportunity.
Some of you might have been wondering who this very distinguished-looking gentleman was on the first slide of my talk. Didn't really have a lot of time to look at it, I guess. But this guy is Paul Ehrlich, and I sort of Can barely imagine working in the laboratory with a double-breasted suit coat using actually an open flame, right? Bunsen burners here, but this in fact doesn't look to be doctored, I would say. And so Paul Ehrlich is widely credited with sort of being the founder of modern chemotherapy. And really he was investigating how different dyes can stain specific structures in the cell. And he basically remarked at some point that magic bullets are basically compounds that can specifically identify a target without harming the host organism. I think that's a very important concept. And Ehrlich was later awarded the Nobel Prize in 1908 for multiple different discoveries. And so I think his major contribution was recognizing the need for selectivity in medicine. Okay, so it wasn't until actually 75 years later that Kohler and Milstein actually developed a process to produce monoclonal antibodies, and for that process received the Nobel Prize eventually. And then a short time later, the first clinical trials were initiated with murine monoclonal antibodies, which in this case actually failed due to human anti-mouse antibody production. And later, that discussion about anxiety early, I think, tripped me up here a bit. So Herceptin actually was developed later by Genentech, and this is really the first FDA-approved antibody, I would say, for the treatment of breast cancer. And then now, in 2009, we actually have over 20 different approved antibody therapeutics with over 100 in clinical trials. Okay, so we're looking at an explosion in new antibody therapeutics with the expectation that about half of these will be approved. All right, so turns out that we can really make antibodies that are highly specific for their target. Okay, but the problem is that the target itself is not confined to sites of disease. Okay, and antibodies then cannot distinguish between healthy and diseased tissue. Okay, so the problem with this is that it reduces the safety of antibody drugs, but also potentially the efficacy of those drugs. And in the case of imaging, for example, in imaging vulnerable plaques, we have reduced selectivity of molecular diagnostic imaging agents, which effectively reduces our ability to pick up those plaques early in the disease process. All right, so to understand sort of the importance of this problem, you need not look much further than some of the approved blockbuster drugs. And I apologize for this slide. This is, again, our Mac to PC compatibility issue. So if you just look at drugs, for example, that target HER2, blockbuster drug, typically considered to be over $1 billion of revenues, these drugs actually target HER2 in cardiac myocytes and lead to cardiac toxicity. For example, antibodies that target VEGF can cause gastrointestinal perforations, kidney disease, and an increased risk of stroke and heart attack. And another example from the cancer space are drugs that target epidermal growth factor receptor. And these drugs can give rise to a very severe and blistering skin rash that, of course, is tolerated, as you might imagine, by oncologists, but really certainly unpleasant, to say the least, for patients. But the problem isn't limited to oncology. And so if you just think outside of oncology, for example, in rheumatoid arthritis, where TNF-alpha is the target, drugs like Humira and Remicade can lead to an increased risk of infections or even, as was recently announced, malignancies. So there really are some severe problems associated with antibody therapeutics, although we tend to think of them as being exquisitely specific. So then you might wonder, well, how could we restrict the activity of an antibody to a site of disease? Okay. And so what we'd really like to have, if you could imagine, is some antibody that somehow was completely dead or inactive in normal tissues. And then upon encountering the disease site, that antibody could be triggered on so that it can essentially bind to its target and exert its function, but then again would be off in circulation. And really, this is sort of what motivated us to pursue the work that I'm going to tell you a little bit more about today. So then the next question is, well, what are you going to use to trigger the antibody? And so we thought certainly proteases look like an interesting opportunity here. Proteases are expressed in just about every pathology you can name. And their activity can be detected locally at sites of disease. So consider, for example, this collagen-induced arthritis model And you can very clearly see the increased intensity that basically is detecting protease activity locally in the joint of this animal. And this is the activity of the protease cathepsin B and matrix metalloproteases. And over here in tumors, of course, there are many different proteases that are expressed and active in tumors, and they include, for example, members of the matrix metalloprotease family, or MMPs. Maybe a more famous example is the kallikreins, of which prostate-specific antigen is a very famous example for the detection of prostate cancer. And then lastly, all those enzymes that are involved in blood clotting, since a tumor looks much like a healing wound. Okay, so we really focused on using proteases as a way to activate an antibody, and since biological systems are already really good at doing this by building proproteins that are regulated by a protease, we asked the question, well, how could we design and build an antibody that responds to a protease? So this sort of comes down to a molecular engineering challenge, and this is the kind of thing that we really enjoy and like to do. And so the strategy is shown here, and it basically involves tethering of a blocking ligand to the antibody. So shown over here is that classic Y structure of an IgG molecule with an important exception that it has a tethered ligand on the outer binding domains of this antibody. And so if you zoom in, basically this proantibody then is composed of a mask that binds very tightly to the binding site of an antibody, and a substrate that can be used to cleave that mask and allow it to float away, okay, to dissociate. So in the absence of the protease, this mask can pop off, right? It dissociates, and that can happen spontaneously. But the reassociation is very fast because of the very high local concentration that's due to tethering. Okay? When you keep this thing tethered, the concentration locally is in the millimolar range, which is a really big number for concentrations. And so in the presence of the protease, that mask is then clipped off and removed, and then we can actually now bind to our antigens. So this is the strategy that we chose to pursue, and in fact, it did turn out to work. But here's what we'd like to do. Effectively, we want to reduce the affinity of the antibody by masking, and this comes back to the therapeutic index idea that we heard earlier in our first talk of the session. And so if you look at a typical antibody, right, it has some high affinity binding curve. This is the isotherm for binding. But what we want to do is block the affinity of that antibody and shift the equilibrium to the right, okay, so that we will not be able to bind our target until the activation occurs. Okay, so that's our goal. And so in thinking about possible applications for this, we just heard much about atherosclerosis. And clearly, it would be an understatement to say that this remains a problem in America and other countries. But in atherosclerosis, just to remind you of a few important points that Jeff mentioned in his talk, and that is that inflammation does occur locally in the plaque, and that inflammation has a specific molecular signature that we'd like to detect in this case. So really, our goal here is to be able to detect the presence of this plaque and those plaques that are most likely to lead to rupture. And so here you can see the cross-section of the artery with a plaque that has actually ruptured, and very clearly see where that rupture has even occurred. So the goal then is, how can we detect this inflammatory process that occurs in the plaque? So to understand how we might do that, you can just think about the simple cartoon of some of the many processes that occur in a plaque. And the first is that cells are recruited from the blood, monocytes. Those cells differentiate into macrophages, and those macrophages essentially attempt to clean up this plaque. They're going to try to remediate the plaque. But in the process of doing so, they actually make a number of molecules that actually contribute to the problem, including matrix metalloproteases that have collagenase activity. So these are proteases that can actually break down this collagen fibrous cap that, as Jeff told us, was, in fact, protective. So the important point here is that our MMPs, these collagenases, are co-localized with specific markers that are present on smooth muscle cells and endothelial cells. And our goal here is to specifically be able to target these particular markers. All right, so the first component we would need to build this molecule would be a mask. And to generate an effective mask, we really need to have high affinity for the target antibody, so this is a selectivity question. or rather very specific for the target antibody. We also want the mask to be of high affinity, so that it tightly blocks the activity of that antibody until protease cleavage occurs. But it can't be so high that this thing doesn't fall off after proteolytic cleavage. So that's really our design challenge. And to do that, we turn to a tool that we've been using for many years, known as bacterial display library technology. And this is analogous to the phage display library you maybe just heard about. The idea is that you produce libraries of billions of molecules displayed on the outer surface of bacterial cells. And in this case, the molecule of interest is displayed in many copies on the surface of an E. coli bacteria. And we can then look for the presence of molecules that can bind to our target, in this case an antibody, that's been tagged with a molecule that binds to a red probe. So this is a really actually simple strategy. We're going to look for things that bind to red molecules and those that do not bind to non-target antibodies, which will be labeled green. And so the benefit of using this approach of displaying things on the surface of cells is that we can measure the properties that we're interested in directly. And so here on the y-axis, you see essentially the amount of red fluorescent binding, indicating things that we'd like to collect or high affinity for the target. And then on the x-axis, we're about looking at non-target binding. Okay, so you can gather from this the things that we don't want bind to both the non-targets and the targets, so they're out here. The things that we do want bind over here. And that simple strategy allows us to collect things that have high selectivity. So I stole from the CytomX website this, I think, sort of intriguing image. And this image basically represents bacterial libraries that display these specific binding ligands. And hopefully this just drives home the point that what we can do is label a specific target proteins with a green fluorophore and non-target proteins with a red fluorophore, and then look for the amount of binding to red versus green, right? So that ratio of red and green fluorescence gives us directly an indicator of the specificity of our molecular interaction. Okay, so we did that for our target antibody that binds to VCAM1, and we obtained a set of molecules that potently bind and block the binding site of that antibody. And typically what we get out of these screens are these sort of maybe cryptic codes to some of you, but many of us can quickly recognize that these are amino acids, and these sequences have a very high degree of relatedness. Okay, so in fact, these bottom two sequences, I think, have 9 identities. A very improbable event from a completely random sequence of amino acids. So then we can quickly characterize the affinities of these masks on the cell surface and get an estimate of their binding affinity. And we use that to select out those to build the pro-antibody that I showed you earlier. Okay, so the second key component that turns out to be absolutely critical, as you might imagine, is the substrate for the protease. It's indicated up here. It's maybe hard to see something that's important here, but our protease substrate in red. And basically, this is a sequence of amino acids that will be specifically recognized by our protease of interest. In this case, those proteases are collagenases, including MT1, MMP, these guys out here, that break down and thin that fibrous collagen cap on the surface of the plaque. Okay, so our substrates need to be cleaved by our target protease, but not cleaved by our non-target proteases. And so to do that, we're going to use just a modification of the approach I just showed you, which is a way to discover peptide ligands. Now, this is a way to discover substrates for enzymes. And so we can display on the outer surface of the cell a substrate with a couple affinity tags, and then add our protease of interest, the collagenase that we know is present in the plaque, probes to tag those termini. And then if we have no cleavage, essentially, we're going to see red fluorescence. And in the presence of enzymes that can cleave that substrate, we're going to see green fluorescence. And those values can be measured very specifically and quantitatively using modern cell sorting instrumentation. So this provides us a very convenient tool to pick out those substrates that are optimum for our protease of interest in terms of activity and selectivity. So one of the students in my laboratory applied this approach to MT1-MMP, a protease that has been implicated in both cancer and cardiovascular disease. And so she screened a random peptide library of just 5 positions initially with a relatively high stringency and low enzyme concentrations and saw the following results. So I think you don't have to be sort of a trained peptide chemist to see that there's a really strong pattern emerging here, right? And that pattern looks like something like PXGL, okay? Or perhaps PXGLM, and then some consensus at the last position. So why is that significant? Well, it turns out that many of these are actually motifs that are found in different collagen subtypes. Okay, so right away from a fully random approach, we've been able to identify sequences that are present in collagens that can represent effective substrates for the construction of a pro-antibody. But if we're going to develop this probe for imaging, we may want to have very rapid activation at the site of the plaque. So the activity of the substrate may also be limiting. And so to tackle that problem, we decided to essentially build better substrates that were longer and have more productive interactions with the enzyme. So here's the idea. Basically, a typical substrate just binds to the active site of the enzyme. We're going to build a substrate that can now bind to the active site and perhaps adjacent sites next to the active site. And to do that, we'll just incorporate the motif we just found into a bigger random peptide library and take the blind approach to discovery here. Okay, apologize for this. But in any case, what we found was that we could identify substrates that had much higher activity relative to that best five-residue sequence. And so then the question is, well, what is that good for, right? What is the improved activity good for? And so we can measure that activity using a simple biochemical assay, as shown here. We actually build fluorescent probes that can act as sensors for this protease activity. And what you can see here is that those substrates that we've discovered using this new approach actually have significantly faster cleavage than substrates that have been reported previously. This is in vitro, so then we looked at the activity of these substrates in cell culture. And so these are actually human tumor cells that are expressing endogenously this enzyme on their cell surface, so we haven't really toyed with these cells at all. They're just making their normal level of MT1-MMP. And we took sequences that have been reported in the literature and compared them to our five-residue substrate and then these longer substrates that we built to achieve rapid activation. All right, so the end result really is that these substrates enable us to directly detect the activity of collagenases in these cell lines. And so we expect that this improved sensitivity might be handy for an imaging application. All right, so then we take these components that we've discovered, the mask and the substrate, and we assemble them into an intact antibody, or in this case, a pro-antibody, simply using recombinant DNA technology, and then express these molecules in mammalian cells and purify them for analysis. And so then we looked at essentially, what are we going to do to the affinity of that antibody by masking? So these data basically represent the change in the affinity of the antibody upon masking that antibody. Okay? So in the absence of MMP, the proantibody has a relatively poor affinity. But when you add the protease, the affinity shifts to a higher value. In other words, the curve shifts to the left. And really, this translates or could be imagined to translate into an improvement in therapeutic index. So the result here is that the proteolysis is actually increasing the affinity by about 500-fold in this case. Right, but we can also look at how these molecules perform in a kinetic sense. And to do that, we can simply here, we're going to compare the proantibody to an ordinary non-modified antibody, and we're going to measure how much of that antibody is bound to a surface over time. Okay, so the kinetics of that interaction. And so for an unmodified antibody, you see that treatment with MMP does not alter this binding response of the phase of binding to the surface and then the phase of falling off that surface or dissociation. But for the proantibody, in the absence of the collagenase, we're basically dead. This thing will not bind to the surface, whereas in the presence of the collagenase, we can now bind to that surface. Okay? So we've been able to use masking to modulate the binding kinetics of an antibody. Well, just to give you the idea, well, this is not just limited to this antibody. I just wanted to give you one other example. So we actually took Herceptin, Genentech's molecule, and directly modified that molecule as well. So here, in the absence of MMP, we have a lower affinity. When you add MMP, you increase the binding affinity. And the same kind of results occur using the kinetic measurements. So in the absence of MMP, very little binding, very slow process, when you add MMP, rapid binding, and a slow dissociation. Okay, so we're not just limited to one target. And so in parallel with our efforts, we founded a company called CytomX Therapeutics that's here in Santa Barbara, and they've been pushing this technology forward aggressively. And so here's one of their examples that they shared with me to present with you today. And here is an antibody essentially that recognizes vascular endothelial growth factor, or VEGF. And so in the case, in the absence of protease, this thing is completely dead, and it will not bind to its target. But when you add the protease, you recover all of the native binding affinity of this antibody, a very tight binding affinity. So this just shows you that you can tightly mask, or very potently mask, the activity of an antibody, and this concept is generalizable. And so CytomX, as I said, took this a step further, and I thought it would be important to sort of give you this punchline from them, and that is that a masked antibody actually does have an improved therapeutic index in vivo. So here what they did was to look at the amount of antibody that is active in tissues as well as in a tumor xenograft study. So these are in mice that are bearing human tumors, effectively. And we're going to measure in red the amount of total antibody that has reached that tissue relative to the amount that's active in that tissue. And we're going to do that in each of these tissues, including the tumor. And so what you can see pretty clearly, I think, is that there's a reduced amount of active material that's present in some of these normal tissues, but increased activity in the tumor. And that material in the tumor is now bound to its target, VEGF. So I think from these data, we can expect that there would be an improvement in the therapeutic index of this particular antibody. And this is really just the first demonstration from CytomX as a proof of concept study. All right, so just to summarize this work, so I basically told you, reminded you perhaps, that proteins and antibodies do exhibit what we call on-target toxicities, so safety problems due to the binding of the target in normal tissues due to poor selectivity. This is not a molecular issue. It's about binding to the target in normal tissues. And I've shown you that we can make antibody-like proteins that have increased in vivo selectivity. And I think really the idea, of course, is to have molecules with more magic relative to that initial concept of the magic bullet. And lastly, just I've shown you that there are a few tools now that actually are sufficiently mature to offer advantages relative to other available tools to discovery of peptide ligands and substrates.
When you put these peptides in the context of the antibody and the mask, does it change the KD and KCAT of the peptide as a substrate? Or did you find a hurdle there for the KCAT?
That's a great question. At this point, when we move the substrates from a cell display or a soluble context in the proantibodies, we don't see a major change in their activity, but the rates of cleavage do change dependent upon their context, as you might expect. But we don't have enough measurements that I can give you a final answer on that today.
The affinity that you have measured, that you have shown, when you add the MMPs or not the MMPs, are they in vitro or in vivo? Sorry. Okay, because I'm asking this. So your molecule will bind the antibody, then you have a peptide that is a substrate for the MMP. So even if you have these cuts of these peptides with the MMPs, the molecule, so it will mask still the antibody. So how would you guarantee that if it's high affinity, it goes out to bind to the target that you want in vivo?
I'm not sure if I completely understand the question, but I'd be happy to talk with you afterwards, see if I can clarify something if something wasn't clear.
Okay, thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.